Thank you for listening to KZYX. This is Rural Resilience, and I am your host, Allison Bailey. For our last show, we talked about at-risk children in Mendocino County with First 5 Mendocino. And today, we have Nicole Luhr with us. She is the Foster Care Program Manager for Tapestry Family Services. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
So, Nicole, please tell me a little bit about your position at Tapestry. What is it that you do?
So as the foster care program manager, I oversee the entire foster care department at Tapestry. And what that kind of entails is supervising our existing social workers and administration staff. I have my own small caseload. But the bigger picture stuff is just really playing a role in collaborating with the Department of Social Services in ensuring that case plans are being met, whether that be reunification or adoption, and just really collaborating with the department. I'm kind of the main liaison between Tapestry and the department.
Excellent. Thank you. And what is it that Tapestry Family Services does for children in Mendocino County?
So there's two folds. We are a foster care family agency, and then we also provide mental health services throughout the community. And the foster family side is I feel that our main role is just advocacy for the kiddos and working with the department and ensuring their needs and services are being met into the best ability. And then the mental health side is we not only serve foster youth in the community, but community children as well. And that's throughout Willits, Ukiah, Covelo, and Laytonville.
Okay, so could we get a little bit more specific about what interventions or what the services really look like, what they consist of?
So on the foster care side, the Tapestry social worker really is the main point for this child's entire world. They're kind of, I describe it as the hub. They are facilitating different avenues, whether it be educational needs, mental health needs, community needs. You know, if they're involved in extracurricular activities, overseeing the foster family home, obviously. And then the mental health piece, we play a really beautiful role in just collaborating with schools and providing education and just supporting the youth and families in our community.
Excellent. Okay. So where does the funding come from in order to provide these programs for Tapestry specifically?
Yeah, so the foster family side is we have a contract with the Department of Social Services to provide foster care and emergency shelter homes. And then the mental health side, we are contracted by RQMC, who holds the contract for Medi-Cal, and we serve Medi-Cal clients. We also get funding from Cal OES, and that is a specific grant to provide services to children that are victims of abuse or crime or bullying. And that's a beautiful loophole for kiddos that don't have Medi-Cal. We can still serve them. And our community really has been a great support. We, you know, the Community Foundation, and then around the holidays, we had beautiful sponsors like Mendocino Forest Products, Fetzer Winery, Salvation Army, donated all the gifts for our foster youth. It was really beautiful. I don't think any child walked away with not what they asked for. And then just other donations for our party that, you know, we throw on that had gift cards from Papa Murphy's and Smoothies Galore and You Top It. And the community support is just really beautiful and overwhelming.
If you're just joining us today, you are listening to KZYX. This is Rural Resilience with Allison Bailey, and we are speaking with Nicole Luhr about Tapestry Services, Family Services, and foster care in Mendocino County. So great, Nicole. Can you give me a couple of examples of what the first 72 hours is like for a child when they enter the foster system? I mean, you mentioned emergency housing. I figured this is kind of where that goes.
Yes. So currently our agency has two identified shelter homes. And so I can really speak to the experiences I've had with those kiddos coming into those homes. It's extremely traumatic for them. They're often really sad and confused and have a lot of questions. Our shelter parents are incredible in just embracing these children and just making it as smooth a process as possible. In those few days, they encounter a lot of adults. Their tapestry social worker will come and just kind of assess, you know, their needs or their wants, or if they need to talk to their county social worker, we'll try to help facilitate that. And then, you know, behind the scenes, there's court proceedings going on determining if the child will remain in foster care or if the child will actually be returned to the parents. So in those few days, it's really just about making the child feel as comfortable as possible, because it's a really severe situation and it's frightening for them.
Yes. What is the determining factor in those critical first couple of days about whether to return or to place a child in longer term care?
So Tapestry is not involved in that piece. Okay. That is like the court piece where the county plays a role. So we're just really sustaining the child's safety at that time and waiting for direction from the county.
Okay. Do we have enough foster families in county to accept these kids?
Well, we're always needing more families. I see once in a while, I feel like, wow, we haven't had a lot of referrals. And then there's times where we're getting so many calls and we just say we don't have the families to sustain this. I think the statistic is around like between 20 and 30% of our Mendocino County kids have to leave the county. And that's really high. And what we want for these kids is to sustain as much normalcy as possible through this piece of their life. So if they have to leave the county, you know, school is disrupted, any kind of community involvement is disrupted. So it's the last resort, really. And our county works really hard in trying to keep kids here.
So what do you think is the biggest contributing factor in not having enough places for these children to stay in Mendocino County? Is it just people don't know that it's an option? They're just not opening up their homes? What's the disconnect?
Well, it's kind of what I'm hoping it is, that people just don't know. There's Tapestry Family Services that people can become. They've shifted the language. It's called resource parents now. And then, you know, we have Redwood Community Services, and the county also is approving homes to be a temporary place for children to stay. I can't speak to really what the issue is, but I'm hoping the more it's put out there, the more people are going to want to be involved.
Yeah, we hope so too. That's definitely part of why we're doing this. I guess feeding into that, what does somebody need to do or to know in order to take one of these children in?
So the first steps with our agency is just a phone call to us, and then we facilitate.
What's that number?
Oh, 485-0334-707 area code. And they would speak to myself or my colleague, Emily Ortiz, and we would schedule an orientation. In that orientation, we just really go over what the process looks like and inquire what they're looking for. There's many options when you're providing foster care services. Some people prefer the temporary or emergency shelter or longer-term placement, or people just provide respite services, which is just a great service to our existing foster homes. It's a period of rest and relief. So, you know, if the family is really struggling with the kiddo or something like that, or maybe they have to travel back east because of a funeral, our respite homes provide care for those children as well in those times.
And so respite homes, I think that's a concept that a lot of people don't really understand. Could you tell us a little bit more about what's involved with that?
Yeah, absolutely. So the process is the same in becoming what's called approved, but they essentially only exist to take kids on the weekend or, you know, maybe for a week at a time, things like that. It's not that the child is placed with them. It's that the child is there temporarily because the resource home has other things going on that the child can't be involved in, or they just need a break from each other. You know, I compare it to having my own children. Like, yeah, it's great when they can go stay with a family member for a couple of days just to rejuvenate and feel good about seeing each other.
Oh, that's great. That's a very good service, and I'm sure a relief for some people who are thinking, gosh, I just can't really take on the responsibility all the time. And
yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So there's something that I think is probably a sort of a nasty rumor around foster care, and that's that there has to be an at-home parent at all times. That there you can't be a foster family if you're, you know, if you have two working parents. Is that the case?
Not at all. Our homes look so different. We have young couples with young children. We have single folks with children or without. We have retired couples that, you know, just have all the time in the world. Tapestry really focuses on sustaining the placement and supporting the family and what their world looks like. And so it's all walks of life. I mean, basically, if you have an extra bedroom with a bed and you can pay your own bills, you are a potential candidate for being able to provide foster services.
Wow, that is much less strict criteria, I think, than a lot of people believe exists. So what about families who have, say, bunk beds? Would it be okay for two children to live in the same room at any time?
Yeah, there's certain, so we're governed by community care licensing, so there's certain rules about age differences on children sharing a room, and of course, gender differences, but there's nothing against them not being able to share a room with a biological child or an adopted child. It's just ensuring that children has a bed and their own space and right to privacy and things like that.
Okay, so that would work. And what about for infants or toddlers? Is the criteria the same?
Yeah, well, basically, kiddos under 2 and under can actually sleep in the room with the resource parents in a crib. So that allows, you know, for folks that don't have an extra bedroom, right, if they wanted to provide care to just infants up to 2 years, they totally could.
Okay, and oh well. Speaking of that, that's actually a perfect segue into the next question. So, can families choose the type of children who they care for, who they foster?
Absolutely. During the orientation process, we really try to navigate what they are looking for and what they feel will best meet their needs, rather that be a certain age group or kiddos with you know, some folks are more apprehensive to take kids with certain behaviors. Mm-hmm. So we take all of that into consideration. I mean, ideally, we want to make a really good match so that while this child is in care, they are getting the best care possible, and we're not concerned about an additional move or something like that if the parents don't feel that it's a good mesh or the kiddo doesn't feel like it's a good mesh.
Yeah, that's great. And thank you for listening to KZYX. If you are just joining us, you are listening to Rural Resilience with your host, Allison Bailey. And we are speaking with Nicole Lohr from Tapestry Family Services about foster care in Mendocino County. So, Nicole, we talked a little bit about general accommodations as far as space and things of that sort go. Is there a certain sort of a safety regimen or protocol that we have to go or that families have to go through in order to take on smaller children, like baby-proofing the house? What are some of the more, you know, the finer details on making sure that the home is ready for a foster child?
Yeah, so during the assessment process, when families are, you know, moving towards becoming a resource home, our Emily Ortiz, our RFA supervisor, will come up to the home and do a walkthrough, and there's certain criteria that we are bound by community care licensing, who governs us, and that's, you know, keeping medications locked up, ensuring, you know, if they had a pool or spa, that there's certain gates put up, things like that. So there's a really thorough checklist to make sure that we're meeting these regulations and that the family is prepared.
Okay, great. Thank you. And are there, you mentioned that, you know, some people are reticent to take on children with behavioral problems or some other things going on. So, you know, which leads me to ask, are there some kids who are harder to place? And if so, why, how does that work?
So our role as the foster family agency is the county calls us and says, hey, we have this kiddo. Do you have an identifiable home that could fit? So it's hard to speak to what kids are hard to place because they think that's more of a county thing. They would have more of a thorough understanding of that. But our role is, you know, what we do kind of specialize is therapeutic foster homes. So we have a few homes, most of our homes actually have additional training to take on some of those kids that have higher behavioral needs. And that's a really beautiful thing to offer the community because I hate the word kind of hard to place because they just see them as children. But yeah, I mean, if they've had significant trauma and really display a lot of hard behaviors, we need to find a really good home that has the tools necessary to meet those needs.
So what kind of a person would be good for that role, for that child? What sort of attributes would a foster parent need to have in order to be up to the task?
And for those higher needo kiddos?
Mm-hmm.
A lot of patience and understanding, and we provide very, very thorough training to initially become a resource parent, and then if they're interested in becoming a therapeutic foster parent, we would provide additional trainings, trauma-informed care, positive discipline, but we would even more so push that, and just really understanding where the child is and how to meet their needs. And there's something I learned a few years ago is behavior is the language of children. So it's really about addressing the behavior and not thinking this child is angry at me or personalizing. They just want nurture and love, and they just need someone with the skills to do that.
I completely agree. And I think I would like to hear, and also our listeners would like to hear, I guess, kind of a step-by-step account of, okay, so they're interested. They call you. What happens next?
So they'd come in and we'd do the orientation. We would tell them about what's to come. And what's to come means there's an interview process. They have an interview with myself about kind of their background and who they are. And they have a home assessment. Excuse me. They also will meet with one of our clinicians for another interview, and they go through a training that we provide. It's a 3-day training. It's about like 15 hours, just giving them the basics of what they need to know to provide care. But you know what I find? A lot of people that are interested in doing this already have some kind of baseline of either experience with children or interest in behavioral health or something like that. And, or, you know, maybe they just, you know, raised their grandchildren and they knew what the need was in the community in providing additional homes. So I've never experienced people coming into this and just have nothing of their own tools. They're always bringing something else to the table. And it's a really beautiful thing to see because we just get to build on what they already have.
Well, that's a really good point. And you've kind of piqued my interest about placing somebody who has some behavioral problems. Do you ever place children with a little extra need with families who already have a child, a biological child with behavioral problems or needs?
Currently, I can't think of a family that has a biological child with the same types of needs that our foster kiddos come in with. But Tapestry really focuses on just pouring in support. And so it's a really beautiful thing to have our clinical side and our foster side really work together. So our clinical team works really closely with the family in, you know, developing behavioral plans and things like that. And it's a very collaborative effort. So if that would be the case, they would be fully supported in every which way. And we would just be promoting safety and well-being in the home and ensuring that the foster family feels safe with this child here, and the kids feel safe too. And I think that's something really important to bring up is, you know, the expectation isn't for these resource homes to change everything about them, to take in foster children, just to build on what they already have.
That's very important, I think. A lot of people are very reticent to take in a new child because they think it's going to completely upend their life, and that's not necessarily the case. Mm-hmm. So, Nicole, it sounds like there's a lot of different ways for people to be foster families, not any just one way. And speaking of which, so people who want to adopt versus people who don't want to adopt, was there a different track? Is it okay to not want to adopt the child that you bring into your family? What's the protocol?
Absolutely.
There?
There's different options. And at the orientation, we kind of navigate what people are interested in. You know, if it's short-term care, long-term care, or they might envision adopting one day. The process is the exact same. If they did move to adoption, they would begin working with state adoptions. It was another state agency like the county that plays that role. We currently have, it's really beautiful, we have 5 kiddos right now on the path to adoption. And some of those parents, you know, they didn't enter foster care thinking they wanted to adopt. So it's really beautiful. And, you know, we just collaborate with adoptions and the department. And it's called co-current planning, where sometimes a kiddo might be looking at being adopted, but at the same time, their biological parents are still working towards get them. So it's kind of this co-current way to ensure that in the end, the child has permanency. And Tapestry's role in that is just really supporting the case plan and advocating for the needs and just working in partnership with the other agencies.
So how is it decided whether or not somebody will go through reunification or be adopted if that's on the table by their foster family?
Yeah, so that piece is really done with the county. If parents lose their parental rights, then the child is open for adoption, is what it's called. But the court proceedings and the court hearings and what that looks like is more specific to the county, where our role is more, you know, sustaining placements, supporting the case plan, and working with what the department is telling us to do. So we're a little bit removed from those big decisions. We do take part in meetings and provide our feedback and our knowledge and our advocacy for what we see as working or not working. But ultimately, that's the county's role.
Okay. And this is the second time that you've mentioned a case plan.
Oh, I'm so
everybody's
sorry.
Really that's common knowledge for people in social work, but for the greater community, they're like, what's on this case plan?
Yeah, I apologize for that. It's so easy to allude to things that I just assume. When a child is put into care, the biological family or parents have a case plan that is developed with the county, and what the case plan is what they have to do to work towards getting their kiddos back.
Okay. And what are some of the common, tasks or factors on that case plan?
Yeah, Tapestry's role is really removed from that, but we know simple things like visitation schedules, and if the family has to take certain classes, things like that. But really, we're a little removed from that. Our role with the birth parents really looks like inviting them to child family team meetings for their feedback, and then if reunification is imminent, which is beautiful when that occurs, our clinical team has reunification therapy that they do with the family that is really beneficial for the outcome.
And what does that therapy look like? Do you know what is concentrated on in that form of therapy, reunification therapy?
Well, a little bit. I mean, I am the foster family piece. Nicole Johns is our clinical director, and she would be a great resource for this specific information. From just my understanding of just being a part of the agency is just assessing the needs of the family and assessing what needs to be the outcome for them to, you know, reunify successfully and then moving towards after that.
That's great. I mean, there's a lot of question as to why a child is removed in the first place and what it takes in order for that child to, be reunified. There's a lot of mystery there. It often seems like it's very severe. Mm-hmm. So So that's, I think, a big question for the general public is, you know, why does this happen in the first place?
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any insight into that?
You know, there's so many different things. We have, in my experience, because, you know, this is more the county and their experiences, but just as the FFA, you know, there's a lot of times where it's just generational trauma and where the parents themselves, you know, didn't have the right tools to raise their own children. You know, in our area is very poverty stricken, and that's a big role too. So there's some societal factors that definitely impact why kids come into care.
How does poverty factor into the removal of a child?
Well, I can't really speak to like the reason for removal, because we don't remove kids. We just assist in placing them. Just in a sociological matter, you know, poverty provides additional stress to families. And if families do not have the tools to address stress, often things come out that are negative and it impacts the entire family. And we really, in our trainings for our foster parents, really touch on a lot of that, of, you know, the importance of seeing the parents as parents. They are still parents and they still love their children and the children love their parents. This is often a systematic or a societal issue. It's not looking at someone because they are bad or something like that. It doesn't feel good to even allude to that.
Oh, I think I'm sure that there's a ton of stigma actually associated with having a child removed from a home,
mm-hmm.
and really vilifying that family. So I'm glad that you said that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You don't want to. It's lots of gray area there.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're just joining us, this is KZYX. You're listening to Rural Resilience, and this is Allison Bailey. And we are speaking with Nicole Lohr from Tapestry Family Services about foster care in Mendocino County. So, Nicole, where, if at all, does our local tribal communities fit into to your services, and you know, just how do they factor into this system? Can they be foster parents, or their, you know, are their children also served by Tapestry when needed?
Yeah, well, absolutely. I mean, this is also a question that's a little more county focused, but just speaking to what our role as the FFA with tribal kiddos, we do have some that are identified tribe members, and what that looks like for us is working with the department, the county social worker, and their ICWA representative to ensure that all their cultural needs are being met. And then when we provide training to our incoming potential families, that's an important piece. There's a cultural competency piece, and because we have such a huge Native population, that's a big part that we talk about. But from my understanding, tribal members can become foster parents, but I actually think that they have the ability to do that within their own community. So I'm not real clear on that piece, but I know that there is a huge need for tribal families because, you know, ideally we want to place kids with their community and with their cultural background, because that's just more of a safety net for them. I don't have enough information to really know what that looks like. I just know what we do when we have tribal kiddos.
Of course, yeah. That's actually very helpful. And I didn't know that they had their own internal structure for that, and that's you know, very interesting. Good to know. So I'll have to do some more research on mm-hmm. that as well. I'm definitely a firm believer in foster care. But from your perspective, and does this really work for children long term? And I think we'd love a couple of stories or examples of some success that children have had through Tapestry.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, that's kind of a hard question because I think establishing a safe and nurturing environment for a child while their parent has to do things required of them to reunify is a great solution to a really challenging issue in our society. But we do have success stories. Our success stories look different. We have beautiful reunification stories where, you know, the parents just needed a little help here and there and they got it. And now these kids are home and they're thriving. And then we have adoption success stories, you know, where now they're moving to permanency and they see these people as their, these foster parents as their parents and are moving towards just feeling belonging and all of that. And then, you know, some of our kids, I have a couple of kiddos where I still see it as a success story where they are in what's called kind of longer term foster care, which we're totally moving away from. Our state in general is, but I have a couple of kiddos that are really sustained in their foster placement, but still maintaining relationship with birth family. So it's a really beautiful thing for this child to just be encompassed with love and all these adults that just love them and can support them for the, for whatever their future holds.
Oh, that's excellent that there are some success stories. Thank you for sharing those. And I'm curious, does age matter? The age of the child? Does the age of the child matter as far as whether or not they have find placement and also whether or not they experience, I guess, individual success through that placement?
I don't think so. I guess a idea would be that teens are harder to place, but really I think it depends on the child themselves, and it's about, if the child has to be in foster care, it's really about identifying a family that can meet that child's needs and that the child is going to be the most successful in. So I don't think age plays a role. I know that, you know, older kiddos, if they have more options in terms of what the county can provide and different programs for independent living skills and things like that. But, you know, I've seen older kids reunify as well. So it just really is a case by case and a child by child. And then what foster homes can provide that care. And then so it's great when people come and they are interested in becoming a resource parent, we get to navigate what are their strengths, what are they most interested in, and then finding a kid that meets that, and that's what's going to create a success story while their time in foster care happens.
Do you work with transitional age youth at all, the 18 to 25-year-olds?
We have, so yeah, we can keep kiddos in foster care up until, I believe, 19. I had an 18-year-old, I think it is 19, actually. And I have had experience with that and just kind of the case plan changes where they are working towards independent living. And so Tapestry's role is just to support that and attend meetings and facilitate meetings and ensuring this youth is ready for the next steps.
And do you work with other agencies in the county as well to provide these trainings, or are they all in-house?
The trainings for incoming foster parents?
I guess thinking more of the independent living.
So the independent living program, I believe RCS has some great programs. I think they manage the Arbor, and they provide an area for transitional youth to go and they take classes. And then the county oversees those programs for those kiddos. So Tapestry's role isn't really training those children, but working their plan with them. Uh-huh. And that, you know, that can look like helping them find job applications or looking into apartments, which is what other people in their life are doing also, but Tapestry's role can be very similar.
Okay, and what's the Arbor?
Oh, see what I do?
That's it's okay.
The Arbor is a youth resource center in Ukiah for transitional youth to go there. They attend classes there. They provide education about finding jobs, finding housing. They're the AB 12 program, which is a program through the county for transitional youth. They, they take classes on budgeting and cooking, and it's really great. I mean, they get to be given these tools that they will need to be successful adults, and it prevents from kids aging out of the system, you know, turning 18 and then just being kind of thrown to the wolves without any kind of sustainability for their future.
That's great. I did not know that we had that program. Mm-hmm. And can anybody use it, or is it, do you have to be part of the foster system in order to go to the Arbor, or do you know?
That piece I do not know for sure. Okay. I only know my experience with our clients.
Fair enough. When a child is removed, and I know this is more of a county thing, but what sort of supports do you wrap around families who have this now missing child, or if that's not part of Tapestry, do you know what becomes of them?
Yeah, so Tapestry's role is kind of removed in that, unless they start reunification therapy with their clinical staff. From my understanding of the system, the family works with the department to develop the case plan that I've kind of brought up. Mm-hmm. And then they develop a way in which they will get their kiddos reunified with them.
Okay, thank you. And so we've talked a lot about foster families and the different ways in which people can work with foster children, but what about schools? What can schools do, or what do they do in Mendocino County to help these kids?
Yeah, I think it really kind of boils down to just being aware and having empathy for the child's situation. I kind of compare it to, you know, if you have a student in your class and you know their parents are divorcing, you're going to be empathetic to behaviors that might come up, or if they start not doing as well academically or something like that, and just playing a huge role in the advocacy for, you know, if Tapestry is holding meetings or the county is holding meetings, it would be amazing if a teacher could play a role in just being there and providing another window into what this child's world looks like. And then there's like the piece of like stigmatization too, like really to stay away from that. It's upsetting when I hear how many children know which children are in foster care. It's not a positive feeling, and it would be beautiful to just have, you know, this inclusive feeling of these kids are just kids. Their story's just different. It doesn't make them different. They're just living with someone for a little while until they get to go back to their home, or they get adopted, or, you know, whatever the case may be.
And do you find that stigmatization leads to bullying for them?
I do sometimes, absolutely. Or just being looked at as different, and no child wants that. You know, the kids have enough to deal with than to worry about. You know, these kids didn't ask to be in foster care. That was not their choice. It was a choice made for their safety, and they have to live with it. So just really surrounding them and support and encouragement and nurture and guidance is what I think everybody in the community can do for these kids, but safely also not like labeling or stigmatizing them, you know, so.
Speaking of stigmatization, you mentioned that you work a lot with children on the mental health spectrum as well. What about mental health in schools for these kids?
Can you elaborate a little bit?
I guess I'm thinking of supports in school systems for children with mental health diagnoses. What is there? What isn't there? What can be done?
Yeah, so our agency, you know, can provide therapeutic behavioral services. It's known as TBS in the schools. Sometimes we implement that in the school setting to ensure that the child can sustain school placement, which ensures the child to sustain foster placement. So we work really closely with the schools, you know, especially if a kiddo has an IEP, where they're at all the meetings, foster care staff and the clinical staff, to really just wrap around this child everything they absolutely need. So we're very involved in the child's school life. And of course, we take direction from the county as well, keep them informed, they keep us informed, and they play a huge factor there as well.
That's really good to hear. And for people who don't know what an IEP is out there, will you elaborate on what that is and how it's connected to the school?
So it's an individualized education plan for children that have identified needs in the school setting, whether that be really academically focused or behaviorally focused. It allows for a child to have extra supports to be successful in school if they require them.
Yeah, that's great. And what sort of factors in school does it look at? I mean, you said academic, but also behavioral. So does that mean what they learn, the classroom setting? What all does that involve?
Yeah, so it's a really individualized program, and there's a full assessment process where they are assessing all academic areas for the child. And then if the child is having identified behavioral issues in the school setting, a plan is set up for, you know, does the kiddo need to go outside when they need a break, or do they need a one-on-one aid, things like that. So it's really individualized to the child, and it's a wonderful thing for our children to be successful in school, because some of them need that.
I think we all need a place in which we can be successful.
Absolutely.
If you are just joining us, this is KZYX, and you're listening to Rural Resilience. My name is Allison Bailey, and we are interviewing Nicole Lohr from Tapestry Family Services regarding mental health and family services in Mendocino County. Okay. So we know what the schools can do, and what about the general public? I feel like the respite care would fit into that, but what else can people who are not able to be foster parents do to get involved with these kids and to make a difference in our community?
Yeah, I mean, we have community members, you know, Tapestry, Rebbe Community Services, the Youth Project, will put on annual fundraisers where people can totally get involved, whether it's volunteering their time or volunteering or donating money, or, you know, if they own a business and that can provide some kind of leeway to help these kids. Another great way is become a GACASA, which is a court-appointed special advocate. It's a voluntary position where they work with the child from start to beginning through their case and just provide advocacy for this kid. They have background knowledge and training in the court systems, in the educational systems. So it's just another great way to put yourself out there to support these kids if you're not able or willing to be an actual foster parent.
Well, that's actually a lot more than I was expecting, quite a bit. So you mentioned business owners being able to get involved. Is that like a sponsorship sort of thing, or what? How can they get involved?
Yeah, that's really where my mind went, was like just kind of the sponsorship piece when these big fundraisers go on. And the community support is already just overwhelming. But if there's, you know, someone out there, it's like, oh, I want to be a part of that. You know, just looking for upcoming opportunities in the community to sponsor. And then, you know, like I brought up the holiday gifts. I mean, what an overwhelming, beautiful gift to give to these kids. And they were just so passionate about it. And just, I can't speak to enough of what we see in our community and what people are willing to give and do. It's just really beautiful.
Yeah, I agree. We have a very giving community. It just, not everybody knows how exactly to be involved most effectively a lot of the time. So mm-hmm. Thank you for mentioning that. And I have a question about prevention. Mm-hmm. So if a family knows that or feels that they are at risk of possibly having a child removed, they've had child protective services involved at some point. Maybe they have some children who they've stayed with, and then other children who are older from an earlier part in their life removed from the home. What can they do to be proactive about making sure that they keep their family intact and keep their kids and themselves safe?
Yeah, so are you speaking to just really stabilizing the home?
Stabilizing the home, stopping, you know, patterns of behavior that have gone on for generations. Seeking help before it gets bad.
Mm-hmm. And that's exactly what it is. It's seeking help. I mean, really getting involved with a mental health agency, Tapestry or RCS, Rebbe Community Services, or the Youth Project. Health piece is huge in just providing family therapy. I know, like Tapestry, we have parent-child interaction therapy, which is a beautiful way to develop attachment with your child. It's like through a one-way mirror where you're being coached on how to respond to your child in certain ways. So really just being vulnerable enough to put yourself out there and get involved with the mental health piece, because there are amazing resources in that preventative measure. And I think it's great you bring that up, and just how can we stop before it begins?
Yes, and I think that there's a lot of families who feel regret after a child is removed, and in some ways, you know, not being able to deal with that and just feeling more and more anger, and then it just gets mm-hmm. worse. I've seen, I've worked with some people who've had severe addictions begin after the removal of a child, and it just made it so that they could not receive the child back into the home because of the addiction, but the addiction was to deal with the emotional pain of losing custody of this child. And I think that that is, you know, that our natural tendency a lot of times is to avoid.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's another great point, just in part of our training process for incoming prospective families is to develop empathy for the birth parents. You know, more often than not, these parents did not want to lose their children. They love them, and they have their own stuff that they have to work on or didn't foresee, or, you know, stressors, or, you know, like, that's a great example of what will happen afterward. You know, we talk a lot about what the birth parents lose too. I mean, we are very child focused at our agency, and I just love that about us. But a piece of being child focused is having empathy for those parents. This is the child's parents, you know, they're always going to love them. And that's really important to point out.
Well, speaking of the child's parents, I'm really curious about how it works or how you encourage it to work between a foster parent and a biological parent, and interactions there that are healthy for the child. How is that facilitated?
So part of the incoming training for incoming prospective parents, we do a piece on relationship with birth parents, and we really try to focus on how beneficial that is for the child. You know, I brought up divorced parents earlier. You know, when parents are divorced, if they do not work together, it is impacting the child in a very negative way. So it's the same thing. If the foster parent, resource parents, and birth families don't work together, it's more confusing for the child. If they can develop a safe way to communicate about the child and have the child see them interact together, it just lets that child know, I'm loved by my parents, and I'm loved by these resource parents, and I am so lucky that all these people care about me so much that I'm going to be okay, rather than this stigma that, you know, birth parents are angry that their child's in care and doesn't want to communicate resource parents, or the resource parents have this misunderstanding and fear of communicating with birth parents. We're really trying to move towards mending that. And it's case by case, really. I've seen really beautiful stories. You know, we have some foster parents that after the kiddos are reunified, the kids still come over on the weekends, and it's a beautiful thing. Like, this kiddo just got an extra uncle or an extra grandpa or auntie in their life, you know? And it's when we have success stories like that, it's just so moving.
Just beaming. So what sort of, scenarios or situations does your agency create to have this be a possibility, this cohesiveness?
Yeah, so it's training. It really is training. You know, some people come in and are already kind of there, and they're like, oh, I want to work with the birth family. I want to know them. I want to know more about them because it'll help me care for their child. Other people come in and they're a little bit more reserved. You know, if they have not had experience with people with addiction or mental health issues, they're more reserved and a little more fearful. So we just really provide that training and support and encouragement to them. I mean, ultimately, I do say, you know, your safety is number one of how you feel about your family. However, how can we move towards you developing a relationship with the birth family? And sometimes, you know, it starts with like letters, you know, I have families that would, you know, when kiddos go to birth family visits, there's like a notebook that goes back and forth and says, oh, you know, Joey did this today, or, you know, his favorite food is peaches, or, you know, something like that. And it just starts building that relationship. And then for older kiddos, I think there's small ways to share schoolwork, you know, school photos or taking. I have one family that it was so beautiful. They immediately said, oh, we have to get a picture of his birth family with him so we can put it in his room. Like, those type of things are huge for these kids. Like, they need to feel like they're okay and they can love different people, because oftentimes we see foster children feeling like they have to choose. And that's never where we want them to be. We want them to just say, oh, my parents love me so much. And now these people I live with also love me. And I'm going to be here for a little bit. And it's all going to be okay.
Yeah, that is absolutely ideal. I think that would cut a lot of the trauma that is associated sometimes with a different placement completely out. Mm-hmm. I think we're close to done, and I would like you to take a moment and think about what you would like to tell our listeners that we haven't covered and that you think is really vitally important information about either becoming a foster parent or supporting an at-risk family or child, and also about your organization.
Yeah, I think what I would really just want to put out there is anyone can do this, and everyone has different strengths that they bring. And there's such a vast... There's so many different types of children that come into care, and it's a really beautiful thing when we get lots of different types of people interested in becoming resource families to meet the needs of those specific children. And I think that often people are apprehensive to think about respite care or foster care because, you know, they have maybe something of their past, or if they don't feel that their home is big enough, or just these kind of misconceptions that really anybody can do this if they're willing. And then if it doesn't work for them, just really getting involved in the children in our community in whatever avenue that looks like for them. And it can start just being a parent, you know, being more involved in your child's life too, you know, just being out there and finding about who their friends are and being involved with the school. And I just think it helps build our community as a whole, and ultimately just, you know, kind of trickles down to all of our children, whether they be community kiddos or foster kiddos.
Well, thank you, Nicole. Yes, I'm wondering, since we've talked a lot about resource families and the different types that are out there, what exactly do they get out of this? Do you have an example that we can discuss regarding somebody just coming in to ask for information and then kind of the end result of what that family ended up with?
Yeah, I think people enter this looking or wanting different things out of it. And when you talk to different foster homes or resource homes, some of them share, they appreciate being able to be a temporary home for them until they get to be with their parents, and just really putting all of the love and nurture they can into them to almost kind of prepare them for this reunification as well. Then, you know, I have therapeutic homes who take some of our highest need kids, and their passion for it is so overwhelming that I feel so gifted to even know these people. They don't give up. They do not give up. They do the blood, sweat, and tears with every walk for this child. You know, they're attending all of the meetings and doing the clinical work with them and communicating well with the department and us. And I can't speak to what they get out of it other than when I see them light up, talk about this child or how excited they are that this child got to go home. I mean, it speaks volumes, you know. We have some beautiful families that work really hard with a lot of different types of situations and children. And I think it fulfills a need. If you're, a nurturer, caregiver, you know, a lot of our folks already work in some type of field with children, right? It's like that passion is there. Or some people just, you know, want to open their home. They just say, hey, we have the extra space. I want a kiddo to be here and us to be able to help out. So it looks different, but all of it is so unique and just really beautiful.
That sounds like it. There's a lot of potential for growth there. Mm-hmm. And how long do children usually stay placed with various families? I guess with respite, it's just temporary. But mm-hmm. but somebody who's more of a foster family, what's the usual time frame from getting into the home and reunification or adoption?
So our emergency shelter homes typically have children no later than 30 days. The emergency shelter homes are designed to be the first stop until they find a placement, which is where the child would go and stay anywhere from 6 months to a year if they are on a strong path to reunification. Now, if there's complications in the case, meaning birth parents, not meeting the criteria of what the county has required, those can be extended. And then, of course, in other cases, the parents may lose their parental rights, in which most of our families have stepped up and said they would be willing to adopt. Some of our other families say, I'm foster care only. I'll support this child in every possible way as an adoptive family is being looked for. So there's lots of options out there, and it's never a guaranteed timeline, because there's lots of like court stuff that happens that, we don't know, especially on Tapestry's end. We're not involved in the legal piece. We just get our information from the county worker that tells us, hey, this is kind of what's going on right now. Court is coming up and it'll go this way or the other way.
Oh, speaking of court, do foster families end up in court at all on behalf of the child, or is that part of the scenario for them?
It's case by case. So some of our families do attend court with the children and others don't. It really depends on where the case is and the involvement that the foster parent is in. So like our emergency shelter homes, where they just have the kids temporarily, they're not going to attend court with the child. Longer placements who have a lot of vital information about the children, they may attend court.
Okay. And I know that no one's expecting this to be totally exact, but I think everybody is interested in the statistics, especially for this county, around the foster care. Are there any numbers that you can give us as far as how many kids are in foster care as compared to other areas? How many homes we still need to have opened up? Just a rundown.
So I know last year the number is around 280 children were in foster care in Mendocino County. If I'm remembering the statistics, it's around about, so I think it's like for us, it's 19 per every 1,000 for Mendocino County. But I think statewide that number is more like 8 or 9 every 1,000.
Oh my goodness.
So yeah, so we are definitely a county that experiences more children in care.
Is why?
Yeah, I mean, kind of what we were talking about earlier, I don't know, we're rural. I think that plays a huge role, and poverty-stricken areas, if we have a lot of drug abuse in our area, things like that, substance abuse. We learned those numbers, it was really impactful. Just, we're a small community, and I love our community, and I wouldn't have thought we were at this rate of where we are.
That's awful.
Mm-hmm.
So how many, just off the top of your head, families do we really need to open their homes in order to accommodate this surplus of at-risk children?
Yeah, so not knowing like how many families total there are, I just know what Tapestry has. We currently have 19 homes, I think about 4 or 5 only provide respite care, which is beautiful. Like, we're super thankful for that. But without knowing like what the county has and what RCS has, Rogue Community Services, my answer would be as many as possible.
Yeah. No, that's fair. That is a huge call to action. And speaking of being an impoverished county, I think a lot of people are worried about, so how do I take care of this child financially once they're in my home? Is there some kind of a monetary compensation for foster families?
Absolutely. It's considered a reimbursement. And that's why earlier I said like the family, all they're required to do is be able to demonstrate they can pay their current bills. The reimbursement from the state varies. The baseline number is around $890. However, dependent on the needs of the child, that can go upward towards $2,400 a month for our therapeutic children. We're in a transition period right now where the county, well, the state is implementing every county to have a more thorough assessment process so that families are getting the monetary reimbursement that is needed to care for the child, and that'll be based on a slew of different criteria, educational, medical, emotional, behavioral, things like that. So there's definitely a reimbursement. In addition to that, they get a twice a year clothing stipend for clothing for the children. Of course, the teenagers always want the, you know, the name brand stuff, but
yes, they do.
and then there's mileage reimbursement provided for transporting children to school of origin, and our agency really tries to support the family in the best way possible, just in terms of well, and you might see throughout the community, like school supply drives or things like that. And we do whatever we can to help the families with transportation, you know, especially for our working families. You know, we usually are taking the kiddos to all the medical and dental appointments and things like that.
Oh, wow, that's a big help.
Yeah, we just really try to support them in the best way possible because we know the challenge it is that they're taking these kids in their home. And we just want them to feel just kind of surrounded with support and not feel that they're in this alone. They always have someone to talk to. We have a 24/7 on-call system for emergencies. They'll be assigned a Tapestry social worker to assist with scheduling, to assist with educational needs, the medical and dental, like I mentioned. So there's a lot of support put into our families because we want them to be, you know, the most successful they can be. And we're just meeting them where they are with their own strengths and then giving them what they need.
So we've mentioned that there are definitely harder children to place because of behavioral problems. But what about physical disability? Is that a factor, or do you take kids who are you know, confined to a wheelchair or have other physical disabilities going on?
So our agency specifically does not have licensure, I don't know if that's the right term, to take what's called medically fragile children. But just as a side note, I see it as a huge need in our community because I have seen this come up a few times where it would be great to move towards being able to have those type of homes, rather it be through Tapestry or other agencies. You know, when we get really high need kiddos that are autistic and things like that, we often can take them within our therapeutic homes depending on the severity. We do have intellectually disability children and things like that, but the physical ailments is something that we currently are not able to provide. So that would be something we'd have to navigate in the future because just being governed by like community care licensing and stuff like that and the different criteria for that.
Certainly, I'm sure it's much much more stringent. And one more time, I want to make sure that if people want to contact you, they can. Mm-hmm. So please give us your phone number, email, website.
Okay. So our foster care office is 707-485-0334. That will give you our main line, and you could ask to speak to myself, Nicole Luer, or Emily Ortiz to get the process started. Our website is Tapestry, F like Frank, S like Sam, tapestryfs.org. Is the website, and my email is Nicole, NICHOLEL, at tapestryfs.org.
Great. Thank you so very much for being here today and for the excellent information. And thank you for listening to KZYX and Rural Resilience with your host, myself, Allison Bailey, and our guest, Nicole Luer, who is a foster care program, foster care program manager for Tapestry Family Services. To listen to our next show, please tune in at 9 a.m. on Thursday, February 15th.